Okay, well, it's time again for You Know What. In case any of you didn't recognize that last tune, that's from a very underrated album by the band Blind Faith, by the same recording that they did, the only studio recording they ever did. It's a really great band. If you haven't heard of them, you need to check them out. Really, really cool. And I thought it'd be kind of a nice intro to our topic today, which is adolescent suicide. A colleague of mine, actually a friend of mine, excuse me, not a colleague, but a friend of mine suggested this as a topic given some of the latest outbreak in the media of adolescent suicides and the sort of how they become much more in the public eye of late, particularly these internet-related dillies. And I'm going to do another podcast probably another week or so on, for lack of a better term, self-defeating internet behavior, which seems to be rampant in our society today on a number of fronts, as most of the parents of the kids I work with can attest. But that's for another podcast. So today I want to talk about some various aspects of suicide. But I want to focus specifically on adolescent suicide, but I'm going to talk about it in general. We have for a long time in the field been studying this phenomenon, and so we know a pretty good bit about it, and I've actually done a couple of workshops on it in the past, so this is a fairly well-known topic to me, unfortunately, for obvious reasons. And certainly my sympathies go out to folks who are survivors and or for folks who have felt the need to do this sort of thing. Certainly I've seen this in my practice with folks who've come in for suicidal ideations, and in some cases attempts, in some cases just gestures. But I want to talk about some of the research studies first. One of the things you want to look at as a clinician is assessing somebody's suicide risk. So if they're coming in for counseling, you want to look at some of the factors. With teens in particular, it's the second leading cause of death among folks between 11 and 24. excuse me, and it occurs in teenagers for a plethora of reasons. I want to talk about some of the factors critical in assessing it, that when somebody is in your office first, and then I'll talk about some things specific to adolescents. Medical seriousness of previous attempts is probably the biggest predicting factor that will cause a repeat suicide attempt, more gesture. So you want to ask about that. How serious was the previous, is there a history of previous attempts? And if so, number two is, what was the medical seriousness of the previous attempts? Was it sort of a gesture, what some people will call a para-suicide attempt, which means somebody didn't really want to die, they're just doing it to get attention or for some secondary gain, they're not really wanting to die. What's the immediate suicidal thoughts or ideations? Does somebody have the hopeless component to their current scenario? Because a long time ago, Aaron Beck talked about the triad of depression involving helplessness and hopelessness for past, future, and current scenarios. Hopelessness is considered to be the more serious of the three. How attracted is the person to the concept of death? Does the person romanticize it? What's this person's attitudes towards death? Do they have a recent history of abusing drugs? They are often related. And when I say drugs, I mean alcohol as well. I don't segregate the two out. So does the person have a recent acute history of overusing or abusing drugs? Has the person had a recent loss or separation? Which would include a death, obviously, of somebody important to them. And the other factor you need to ask is the family history of suicide. Suicide does run in families. That is absolutely true. And you'll see that a lot with folks. And I think that's partly from a role modeling perspective, but I also think it's from a genetic, for lack of a better term, a genetic foobar, as some of you have heard me describe it, biochemical brain farts, BBFs, that are somehow transmitted, whether it's a proclivity for depression or a propensity for anxiety or schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, all of those have a pretty high increase the risk for suicide stuff. But whatever it is, the family history is really important. So let's talk about what factors are more likely to make teenagers more vulnerable to suicide. Probably developmental issues are number one, or certainly an important factor. So as most of you know, developmentally, teens are in this sort of no person's land time, as G. Stanley Hall used to call it, of storm and stress. And I think that's probably true for a lot of kids, particularly the earlier they're introduced to things like, you know, sex and drugs and violence and whatever. having to make decisions about, you know, academics or occupational goals and breakups with boyfriend, girlfriend, significant others, divorce, whatever, right? So developmental issues, having to assume adult responsibilities, that sort of thing. So that's all pretty standard fare. Certainly a comorbidity of behavioral and or personality disorders, some of which are more common to teenagers, particularly substance use abuse and or addiction. Hanging out with that goes along with this is hanging out and accompanies this as having dysfunctional relationships, which include both peer and family. So hanging out with other peers who are sort of suicide prone or, you know, have other emotional issues. Dating partner would be included in that. Having family members that are unsupportive, distant, or strained relationships, divorce, remarriage with blended family, and most blended families aren't the Brady Bunch. or having some kind of chaotic or disorganized family or something that, a family that moves a lot, there's a lot of unrest, there's no stability. And societal factors. So obviously if you're a poor kid, or your family's poor, that's obviously not a great thing. If you live in a war zone or live in an area where there's a lot of gang violence, obviously that's not a good thing. If you are subject to a lot of ethnic or racial or some other type of bullying type things or, you know, castigation because of your sex or race or ethnic origins, or in some cases being gay or bisexual and being open about it, or having been outed inappropriately by someone that she didn't want to be outed, or what, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. Also, you know, do you belong to a religious or spiritual orientation that most people are unhappy or scared of or whatever, Wiccan paganism being the first one that comes to mind, but there's a bunch of them. There's also a lot of myths going around that are completely unsubstantiated about teen suicide, and I want to talk about those too, and they are, the typical ones I hear are the following. You'll hear some folks say, oh, well, people who talk about it just really aren't that serious about it. And while that may be true, that's definitely not true because, for the most part, because most teenagers give signs and symptoms. They're just a lot more subtle about it, right? Myth about suicide is that once a kid is suicidal, that person is always and forever considered to be quote-unquote at risk. And what I'd say is it certainly puts them at a higher risk, but it doesn't, that doesn't mean they have a lifetime of risk, right? Most people who are going to contemplate seriously suicide or attempt suicide are usually going to do it within the first 24 to 72-hour period. Another myth is if a teen attempts to suicide and survives, fails, a real suicide attempt, not a parasuicide attempt slash gesture, that teenager won't make additional attempts. That is completely and utterly false, and that's also false for adults as well. Generally speaking, the research is pretty clear that folks who survive their first suicidal attempt, both adolescent and adult, are 10 times more likely to try it a second time and a third time. All right, because after they do it the first time, it sort of takes the fear out of it. It's like, well, heck, I did it the first time. I got over to that little ooh hump the first time. Second time won't be as hard. And that's true. For them, that's absolutely true. another myth is that people, particularly teenagers who kill themselves, always leave notes, suicide notes. That's not true. There's only about 30% of the suicide population who actually leave notes. They're adolescents. Another myth is if you're a person, adult, a friend, whatever, who suspects that your son, daughter, best friend, neighbor's kid, whatever, is suicidal, you don't talk about it and you don't use the word suicide because it might give them ideas, quote unquote. That is utter nonsense. If you suspect somebody's suicidal and you have the ability to talk to them and you feel like they'll listen to you, always bring it up. And if you're a parent and suspect it, you need to jump on that stuff like, you know, stink on a June bug if you're from the South. Y'all know what I mean. Hey, I'm from the South. Okay, I can make fun of this stuff. All right. The other big myth is that strongly religious teenagers will not attempt suicide. That is really false. In fact, the research is pretty clear that Catholic teenagers are much more likely to attempt suicide than non-Catholic teenagers. So there you go. All right, so what are some classic myths that we have? What are some classic, we talked about the myths. What are some classic suicidal symptoms and signs that you can look for? Okay. Sudden and significant behavior changes. Most of you know this. So drop in grades, some kind of eating problem, running away, experimenting with drugs, sexual, any kind of acting out, sexual acting out, drugs, running away. In some kids, particularly younger kids, you'll see more anger outbursts than depression. Most people think that suicide is a depressive act, and that's not always true. It can be a kind of a pissed off, excuse my French, fuck you statement, too. It's very, very often that for teenagers. A loss of interest in activities or friends or whatever that the teenager previously found very pleasurable. That's true for adults as well, by the way. And periodic chronic depressive signs and periods. That's also true of adults. As we stated earlier, a lot of kids will give verbal cues. They'll hint around, and they're waiting for somebody to pick it up. They really do want help. Most people don't want to kill themselves. They just, as Edgar Allan Poe might say, they want surcease of sorrow for the lost Lenore. Most teenagers who kill themselves don't really want to die. They just want to be out from all the BS, right? Which is not necessarily true for adults, because a lot of adults really do want to die. Teenagers also have often have a preoccupation with or repetitive themes of escape avoidance stuff, wanting to die and join someone who's already died that they were very, very, very close with. Sometimes you'll see these suicide pacts among best friends or lovers or whatever. And as I said, sometimes the cognitive theme is one of martyrdom or revenge. And in fact, there's a really, 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 if any of you are familiar with the band Rush, one of my all-time favorite bands, they have a great song. It is off, I think, their Presto recording called The Pass. And as usual, their drummer, percussionist Neil Peart, writes most of their lyrics. The guy is just a genius. I mean, besides being just an uber, like, woohoo drummer, he's a fabulous lyricist, in my opinion. If any of you guys or gals out there don't know that song, check it out. It is really, it's heavy. I mean, I don't have any other way to describe it. It is a very great, the lyrics to the song are just fabulous. For those of you who don't know, it starts out, proud swagger out of the schoolyard, waiting for the world's applause, rebel without a conscience, martyr without a cause, static on your frequency, electrical storm in your veins, raging at unreachable glory, straining at invisible chains. And now you're trembling on a rocky ledge, staring down into a heartless sea. Can't face life on a razor's edge. Nothing's what you thought it would be. All of us get lost in the darkness. Dreamers learn to steer by the stars. All of us do time in the gutter. Dreamers learn to turn to look at the stars. turn around and turn around and turn around. Turn around and walk the razor's edge. Don't turn your back and slam the door on me. Those are just fabulous lyrics. Had a patient one time many years ago for whom this was very, very poignant, and I really believe saved this patient's life when I brought this up and talked about it. I often use music in my practice, and this is a really great example of that. The second verse is something like, it's not as if this barricade blocks the only road. It's not as if you're all alone in wanting to explode. Someone set a bad example, made surrender seem all right. The act of a noble warrior who lost the will to fight. Isn't that great? I just love this stuff. No hero in your tragedy, no daring in your escape. No salutes for your surrender. Nothing noble in your fate. Christ, what have you done? It's just love. Their stuff is just awesome. This is another reason why Rush is one of my all-time favorite powerhouse trio bands. Besides the fact that they're fabulous musicians. Always did like smart and talented folks. So that's really a great summary of what adolescent suicide is like. And obviously these folks have known someone who've done that or experienced some feelings of someone close to them. What are some psychological and socially interpersonal indicators, what I call socio-interpersonal indicators of teen suicide? And most of these are not going to be a shock to any of you out there. Folks with low self-esteem, low self-efficacy, folks have heard me talk about that term before, or poor self-concept with accompanying inadequacy feelings. These often coincide with depression or with a chronic dysthymic disorder, which most of you have heard from a previous podcast of mine. That's sort of the wimpy, wimpy, wimpy version of depression, but it's no less serious. Also, folks who are highly suggestible and or hypersensitive are more at risk. Folks who are perfectionistic. You often will see this with gifted kids. And a lot of people will come up to me and talk about, oh, you know, those gifted kids are really smart. They're making really good grades. What do they have to worry about? Well, let me tell you what. Gifted kids have a lot of emotional problems because they are not like their peer group. And I'm talking from personal experience because I was a gifted kid. I am a gifted adult. But I can also tell you that as a kid, and probably as an adult too, let's just be perfectly blunt and honest, I was pretty emotionally retarded. So I might have been, 15, due in college, but I might have had the cognitive gifts of somebody a lot older than I was, my age. But I can tell you that my emotional development was somewhere next to an echinoderm. Or a snail. It was pretty pitiful. I get a laugh about it now. It wasn't funny at the time. But I'm still pretty emotionally retarded. I still have very youthful emotions, and I hope to Jesus, God, Buddha, Satan, Allah, and any other deity I can name that I never, ever lose the ability to feel young. But to do that in a more emotionally mature manner, which has always been my struggle. Part of that, if you're really gifted and smart, is most gifted, smart kids and adults are pretty perfectionistic, and that's certainly true in my case. Again, most of you have heard me joke about my obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, and while I joke about it a lot, it ain't no joke, folks. It is a real entity and exists and is alive and well in this body. So folks who do that are often disappointing themselves, so they feel that they've let themselves down, their friends, their family, whatever. People who do sudden changes in social behavior, particularly with adolescents, giving away really prized possessions. So if you see somebody who's giving away awards, if they're an athlete, or giving prized bicycles or motorcycles or guitars or musical equipment or whatever, grades dropping, academic deterioration and or failure from an otherwise, normally pretty good kid in terms of school academic stuff. Sometimes the attendance will also deteriorate. The kid will stop going to school. Or if you have persons who are typically underachievers, so you'll see that with persons with learning disorders or attention deficits, because they're not, their brain, and you folks have heard me talk about this, that their brains aren't able to access what their brains are able to do. So it's like having a program in the computer. I often describe it as having enough RAM but not being able to access or allocate the RAM memory. And so if you feel like you're failing to do that, a lot of times that leads to a condition that most of you have heard that Martin Seligman made famous called learned helplessness. This is the guy that shocked the dogs in the cage and prevented them from jumping into the next cage, or shocked both cages, so no matter where they jumped, they would still get the crap shocked out of them. So they just sat there and whined, and while the guy shocked them, they just quit doing anything because they'd learned that whatever they did didn't matter. That's where the learned helplessness studies come from. Obviously, we wouldn't be able to do that today. A lot of the research that we have today that has informed us has come at a cost to either people or other animals, which is really kind of sad. But, you know, I tell everybody, ain't nothing for free. There's no free lunch. And that is absolutely true. Okay. What are some family indications that your teen is more at risk at suicide? Families that struggle with the notion of the kid being part of the family and kind of being dependent on the family, yet at the same time with the family recognizing they need to be autonomous, they need to be independent, they need to start to learn to spread their wings and fly away, as Freddie Mercury might sing, were he still alive. What another great vocalist. Holy shoes. Anyway, so if they have this ambivalence and the struggle between independence and autonomy for their kids, they'll often do things to undermine that, and the kids get really confused about that. Obviously, if there's abuse in the home, whether it's physical or sexual or emotional, and I once heard a saying, and I don't remember where I heard this, but it is absolutely true, that sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but words hurt worst of all. And that is true. That is absolutely true. Words, particularly from someone in position of authority that the teenager respects or loves or keeps in high esteem, can really, really hurt if the words are said in anger or caring, in a sort of non-caring, sort of careless sort of way. So any kind of abuse situation. If you have severe economic deprivation in the family, you know, that, I mean, let's face it, people who can't afford, you know, to live in nice places are more at risk. There's more danger, there's more filth, there's more, you know, there's less good food that's usually eaten because food costs money. There's more illness and less ability to pay for, you know, proper treatment. People get desperate and start using, you know, drugs or alcohol, or parents leave, or parents kill themselves, or parents become non-functional, or there's increased conflict. It's just, you know, not having money is bad, okay? To quote Mr. Mackey, and particularly in our economy, as most of you know, since the economy took a crap in 2008. Thank you, Washington. Anyway, don't get me started on that. If you have a family that in discord, so the family is disintegrating, right? There's all this huge conflict, or you know, the parental figure dies or leaves, or they have divorce or separation, and the family unit kind of disintegrates. That's not functioning like a good corporation, so to speak. Kid was running away from home, oftentimes because the family's kind of foobarred, but sometimes they're trying to run away from their own issues, you know, and I tell people all the time that want to move away, you know, that's what that saying, wherever you go, there you are, that's what that saying means. It means you can't run from yourself, you know, you can't hide from yourself. Wherever you go, you take your stuff with you, you know, which is why when I work with a lot of addictions people, and, you know, and I've had addicts say to me, oh, Doc, you know, Chuck, I know every drug dealer in the Atlanta area, or I know every drug dealer in Columbus, Ohio, or I know every drug dealer in wherever this person's living. And if I could just move to Vegas, right, and, true story, or if I could just move to Miami, oh, yeah, right, there's no drugs in Miami, right, or if I could just move to Chicago, if I could just move to, right, and I don't care if you want to move to Oshkosh, Wisconsin, okay, dude. Right, or dudette. Right? Wherever you go, you're taking your shit with you. That's what's causing you to take drugs, right? Not your buddy going, hey, dude, hey, honey, this is some good shit, right? No, stop blaming other people for your crap, Right. It's you know, and you guys have heard my story with this addiction thing, so don't even go, I have a disease, and oh my God, my parents are making it. Yeah, okay, great. I got some great cheese to go with your wine, okay? I'd love to claim that one, too, but unfortunately, that's not mine. That's unashamedly stolen from a buddy of mine who's nicknamed the Brat Man in Vancouver, and what a cool guy he is. At any rate, thank you, Terry. So, you know, these people that want to escape avoidance, what's known in the addiction business as the quote-unquote geographic cure. I'm just going to move, and things are going to magically get better. Praise Jesus! Yeah, right. You can praise anybody you want, but your butt's still going to be dysfunctional, which means you're probably going to go back to drug. You may not know any drug, you know, dealers or whatever. That's what this guy was trying. It's like, oh, don't see, I don't know any dealers in Miami. The guy was trying to move to Miami, right? I don't know any drug dealers in Miami. I can just move there. Uh-huh, right. You don't know any drug dealers now, okay? I guarantee your patooties, within a week, you'll know every frickin' drug dealer within a 5 flippin' mile radius of where you live and work, okay? I know you. This has nothing to do with, you know, oh, let me just go inpatient so that I'm not tempted to use drugs or whatever. Well, that's great. What are you going to do when you get out of inpatient? Because most of those people don't teach folks how to do drug refusal stuff. And then they're going to put you right back in the same environment and you're still going to have the same shit, different day. Okay, please. Stop this escape avoidance shit. There is no running away from yourself. All right. Unfortunately, I can't wave a magic wand and go, the spirits are about to speak, right? One of my favorite Bullwinkle ones. Anyway, it's like, come on, guys. Folks who have irrational or unrealistic expectations of their parents or their teachers or themselves or their, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend, or whatever, not a good thing. And as I mentioned, family history of suicide behavior or suicidal threats, particularly the gestures, because most of the gestures, the so-called parasuicidal attempts, are really just escape avoidance tools or ways to get their secondary gains. I'm going to escape turning, you know, if you make me do my homework, I'm going to kill myself. Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Well, hope you got a really big bottle of arsenic, okay? So, what are some emotional, psychological indicators of adolescent suicide? Well, as I once said earlier, talk of self-harm or suicide, serious self-harm, prior suicide gestures or attempts, preoccupation with death, so people who, you know, write essays on death or their poetry or art or music is like, or movies they see are all about death and destruction and all this crazy stuff. Now, again, I don't want to make people paranoid because, you know, back in the 80s, you know, rock music got this bad rap with this, oh, it's devil music. All right. Well, let me tell you, and I've said this before in my podcast when I talked about it, I'm going to say it again because it bears repeating. Nobody can make you do a flipping thing, period, end of story. Right, people who are preoccupied with suicide are listening to suicidal stuff, writing suicidal poetry, watching TV movies about suicide, reading, you know, famous literature pieces about suicide, you know, watching, you know, for the millionth time Romeo and Juliet, whatever, right, because they're looking for somebody to identify with. The movie did not make them kill themselves. Reading the book did not make them kill themselves. Listening to Judas Priest lyrics did not make them kill themselves, okay? And any of you people who really believe that, no offense when I say this, and please excuse my rudeness, but you're either psychotic, dumber than dog poop, or just really out to frickin' lunch, right? Because with that logic, and you guys heard me say this on a previous podcast, you know, you want to talk about, you know, murder and incest and rape and war and killing people and taking revenge, right? Well, there's a book you need. You want to start banning and burning books. There's a book you need to ban. It's called the Bible because there's a lot of that shit in there, right? And again, I'm not slamming the Bible. I'm just telling you, if you want to find dirty, quote-unquote, stuff, you want to talk about all kinds of crazy shit, you don't have to go far to see it. And we're not talking porn movies or, you know, smut books. We're talking very, very famous books, okay, that most people would consider either sacred or, you know, well-written or whatever. So get this crazy idea that something external can cause somebody to do something, okay? Nothing can cause anybody to do a damn thing. People do it because they're either not thinking, they're impulsive, they're upset, they make mistakes, they're foobard, whatever. Okay? Enough said. Repeated exposures, repeated episodes of self-destructive behaviors and thoughts, serious stuff. And that can include things like, oh, I'm going to go, spelunking without buddies. That's a, cave examining. It's too nasty for me, but, but I'm a wuss. What do I know? Or we're going to go mountain climbing or rappelling, and I'm not going to use a safety rope, or I'm going to parachute, and I'm going to, quote-unquote, forget to take a safety chute, right? Or I'm not going to double-check my packing, or I'm not going to go with a buddy, or I'm not going to go deep-sea diving with a buddy. I'm, stuff that's like, oh, please, are you kidding me, right? Obviously, folks who have overt psychopathology, such as delusions, hallucinations, schizophrenia-type stuff, folks who have huge amounts of incapacitating blame for themselves, shame, guilt, or any kind of, unrealistic phobia or fear of punishment, right? That somebody's going to do something, you're going to get grounded. Oh, my God, I can't stand it. I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to be grounded for a week, right? People who have obsessive doubts about themselves, usually through disappointing friends or parents or whatever. People who have phobic type anxiety, right, or people who have very serious clinical depression, right, people who use substances a lot, right, they're at much more risk for killing themselves than folks who do not use stuff. And, any one or two of these is probably not a big deal. When you start seeing four or five or six of these bad puppies up, then you need to start really getting, jiggy on somebody's butt and really go, okay, what the hell's going on here? Okay. What are some predisposing factors in terms of personality aspects that are most highly correlated with people who go through suicide? The biggest, and I'll talk about, there's a bunch of them, but I'm going to talk about the big five. People who have chronic, what they used to call depressive personality, folks who have large amounts of and long-standing chronic depression. People who have low-standing self-esteem, self-concept, self-efficacy. People who have, and I mentioned this earlier, the Aaron Beck helpless, hopeless component. Big correlation to people who suicide. Folks who are more dependent than others, right? They have a more dependency. They're more clingy. They're more, usually because they're unsure of themselves, they have low self-esteem, low self-concepts, low self-efficacy. This makes pretty good sense, right? And people who tend to be more impulsive, right? Actor outers as opposed to actor inners. That's what I call people who are compulsive ruminators like myself. I'm an actor inner. So I don't do my things outwardly. I sit there like a bump on a log, like a frog on a pond, going ribbit, ribbit, except I'm thinking about it. I'm ruminating it. So I'm an actor inner. I'm acting inside, right? There are certain disorders that are really highly related. Any of the cluster B stuff, particularly. And you guys have heard me rail about this before, borderlines, narcissists, and histrionics. Usually the antisocials don't because they don't have enough core. And the borderlines don't have a core either much, and the narcissists don't have a core either. But the antisocials are so coreless that they would know why they're going to kill themselves or go out and kill somebody else. Right? Borderlines, histrionics, narcissists, the cluster B folks, the bipolars, big correlation of bipolar and suicide. Low frustration tolerance, that's not a disorder, but that's also correlated, but not as high as the first five I talked about. Substance abuse, and I've mentioned this before, one of the huge risk for suicide, people who are regular substance abusers, college students because of the change from high school to college, most of them moving out of state or moving into dorms, moving out of home, that's the change, right? And previous folks who have had previous attempts, one of the biggest predictors that you're going to do it again. I mentioned earlier, 10 times more likely. Okay. What are the differences between teenagers who want to commit suicide and or who do versus adults? Well, the major differences are that adolescents are typically much more likely to abuse a variety of different substances. They have lower sense of self-esteem and self-efficacy. They tend to be female. They tend to come from dysfunctional families. As I mentioned before, they come from very dysfunctional families, usually divorced. They've often attempted suicide before. And they usually suffer from what's known as the contagion effect, which means they know somebody else in their immediate social arrondissement who has done suicide, or their family, and it sort of like catches like the flu. It's contagious. And sometimes they seek to get revenge on people, so it becomes a passive-aggressive fuck you statement. And I've mentioned that before. Excuse my language. All right, the similarities between adults and teenagers who kill themselves or who attempt serious suicide, there's four biggies. They're under chronic stress. They're chronically depressed. You know, well, duh, right? Because you folks have already heard me say before, stress is a form of anxiety. If you have anxiety disorder for more than 2 years, you're going to be depressed because you're depressed about being stressed. Like, duh, right? They tend to be more socially isolated, and they tend to cope with life much more poorly. So that's the big four similarities between adults and kids. Okay. So we know all that kind of stuff. By the way, in case you didn't know, there are certain ethnic groups that are much more highly at risk for suicide than us white bread folks. And I can speak for myself, even though I'm a white bread ethnic guy, I'm still considered kind of WASP-esque, right? When you're looking at specialty groups, Turk Island and Micronesia Island adolescents have similar patterns of suicide to Native Americans because of the way that World War II changed their life. And so let's talk about Native Americans. Native Americans are most commonly gone towards suicide for the reasons of feeling like they don't have a real home because they come from either dysfunctional homes or dysfunctional parents. They've been moved oftentimes as a result of that. They've been moved from foster placement to foster placement from foster placement, and they don't really have any grounding. And let's be honest, you know, us white folks have just really disenfranchised the piss out of them, much to our shame. So in many ways, they've lost their roots, their heritage stuff. And some of them have also not been able to successfully been acculturated into our, you know, white bread Anglo-Saxon sort of society. So you could see why they would have more issues with that. Japanese youth has always been higher than most Western cultures, particularly among the university populations, and part of that involves the cultural emphasis on quote-unquote saving face and seeing that success and honor that one has on oneself also gets reflected onto one's family and is also a reflection of one's ancestors. So it's, if you dishonor yourself, you've dishonored not only yourself, but your family and your ancestors. And in order to save the family face and save your face and to sort of do something with dignity, you off yourself, right? The harakiri. Okay. Although, obviously, not every Japanese person, you know, pulls out a sword and does their dilly, right? Okay. excuse me. Triggering factors, and I talked about suicide being an internal state, but there are certain triggering factors that, again, think about this like a crapshoot, right, or anything gambling, right? The more of these things you have, the worse off the scenario is, okay? So certain triggering factors, and I mentioned this before and I'm going to say it again, substance abuse and dependency, huge, and even substance use, because most people, a lot of kids, teenagers, will kill themselves when high and drunk, even if they don't have a quote-unquote drug problem per se. A lot of teenagers will get drunk or get high because they don't have the quote-unquote balls to do it while they're straight, while they're alert. And by the way, when I use the word straight in this context, I mean drug straight. And in fact, I always referred to myself as drugs as straight, and, you know, not meaning a sexual dilly. So it's interesting how society has changed the sociocultural meaning of certain, you know, jargonistic terms. But anyway, drug straight, they can't do it when they're sober. That's a better word. And so they'll get drunk or stoned or whatever so they can lose their inhibition to do stuff. As I mentioned earlier, tendencies towards impulsivity, particularly if you have this contagion from other social role models, people in the media that they idolize, like Kurt Cobain, for example, back in the day, you know, or any of these, any close friends, family members, whatever. If they're under like ridiculous amounts of pressure to achieve and they feel like they can't do it or they're tired of trying, and if they have failure experiences in life areas that are very, very significant to them, right? Teenage pregnancy, also another predictor, particularly for females, obviously. And, you know, if you're a guy and pregnant, let me know. I want to, you know, get in on this action so I can, you know, make some money off the Guinness Book of World Records here. So that's those are all sort of triggering factors. Behavioral indications, as I mentioned, include things like giving away personal properties, academic failures, academic decompensation, eating or sleeping habits that are changed drastically, self-deprecation comments, feeling worthless, that sort of thing. And as I said, using substances. Did I mention using substances? The other thing is kids who collect or have weapons, access to weapons. That's another huge sort of situational factor. So if there's somebody in the home that you suspect is suicidal, get them knives and harakiri, you know, ceremonial daggers and guns and all kinds of, you know, TNT, it's dynamite. Sorry, I had to do that. Yeah, I know my jokes don't get any better. I'm sure that, you know, AC/DC boys will forgive me. So, basically, what you, you know, what do you want to do? Well, if you see somebody, if you know somebody, right, even if they've come to you and say, you know, you're their best buddy in the world, and they've come to you and they've said, look, I'm really thinking of doing it, or, you know, here's my, you know, 1959 Gibson Les Paul, I want you to have it kind of thing, or, you know, anything, if you suspect somebody, or if they tell you, you know what a real friend is? Somebody who gives a shit enough to risk the relationship to do what's right for the relationship. So if somebody gets you to swear on a Bible or the Torah or the Quran or the Kabbalah or the Necronomicon, I don't care, right, that you're not going to tell anybody, and somebody comes to you, get off your butt and get mouthy as hell. Now, here's what you don't do. You don't go on YouTube and get mouthy. I'm going to talk about stupid internet behaviors later, but and those things abound in just ridiculous amounts, but and that's true with adults too. So we're not, you know, we're certainly not immune to being stupid on the internet. I'm doing good to turn my computer on, but that's another stretch of stupidity of another kind. At any rate, you know, go tell somebody in authority. Go tell a teacher. And you know, if you're a kid and your best friend has just told you, or your girlfriend is just, you know, and you really believe them, right? This is not a manipulation ploy to get you to have sex with them or to stop having sex with them or give them, you know, your Les Paul or whatever. Go to somebody in authority that you trust. And all of you guys and gals out there, you know who adults, which adults are cool and who's not cool, right? So go to a parent, that you, if you have a parent that you know, the kid's parent, your own parent, whatever, your, if it's a brother, sister, you know, your parents, whatever, go to somebody who can intervene. Go to a pastor or a minister or a rabbi or, you know, a high priest of your coven or whatever. Go to a coach. You know, go to a counselor, go to, you know, whatever, anybody, a teacher, anybody who you trust to alert as many people as you can if you don't feel like you can trust this person not to kill themselves, that they won't give you an agreement, yeah, and you don't believe them, and yada, 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 right? Really, 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 really jump on this with both feet, and, you know, I know you promised, but I'd rather be a liar with a live friend, so to speak, and me lying to the friend that I won't tell anybody because I had the greatest intention to save this person's life, whether they really want you to save their own life in the minute or not. You know, and if you're an adult and you don't have, you know, all this other crap going on your plate and you're not crazy and whatever, and you have a certain situation, you know, I really, and I'll say this and I know people are going to go, oh no, he did not say that. Yes, I did, and I'm probably going to say it again. You know, there are certain conditions. If you're an adult and you're not, you know, delusional, you're not psychotic, you're not under the influence of drugs and alcohol, you know, whatever. I do believe that there are times when I think an adult has the right to take his or her own life under certain scenarios. And I don't like it, and I don't, you know, I don't support it in terms of somebody comes into my practice, I don't go, well, you know, if you really want to kill yourself, no, right? But I do, you know, somebody who's got a terminal disease they're going to die from in the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks, they're going to be a shitload of pain, and there's no foreseeable whatevers. You know, there's certain situations, and, you know, we could argue this and talk about this all night, and I'm certainly not advocating suicide, and I don't want anybody to hear that or to mishear that. But I do think adults have the right to decide what they're going to do with their lives, and I think under certain circumstances, they have the right to do that. But I certainly don't like it, and if somebody were to tell me, I would certainly do every freaking thing I possibly could to convince them that's a bad idea. So if you're a kid, do the same thing. Don't sit there, because there's nothing worse than having promised a best buddy you're not going to do it, and then you're going to go, and then your person does it. You pray to Jesus, God, whatever, and you get the person to say, okay, I promise to wait till tomorrow, right? You get up tomorrow and you're reading the paper, or, your parents say, hey, your buddy's died last night. I cannot even begin to tell you how much guilt you're going to have, right? Because I've seen it. I mean, I've seen people come into my office with this kind of stuff going on, and it's just really freaking sad. I mean, it is really, really, really sad. Please don't be one of those people. Okay. If you are a person who is in a family of someone who has killed themselves, adult or kid, or your best buddies or whatever, right, get help, right? Do whatever you can to make the situation better. Don't try to do this alone, right? It's really, really hard. Now, I know most people want to, get away and isolate and stuff. It's kind of a common thing, even though we already know that isolation is not a good thing. It increases the likelihood for depression, increases the likelihood for you to kill yourself, increases the likelihood for anxiety, and for you to ruminate and go over stuff and not have anybody to bounce stuff off of. But please get some help for yourself. Again, I don't care who it's from. I don't care if it's, talking to your dog, the family dog. And I'm really not being funny. Pets are a great source of support. They're a great source of companionship. Do whatever makes you feel good, as long as it's not going to hurt you. Don't cut, obviously. That's a bad idea, okay? Cutting is bad, okay? Unless you're cutting up greens for a salad, right? Bad idea. Or cutting a slice of cheese for yourself. So, as opposed to cutting the cheese. Ba-doom. Okay. Yeah, we all know my jokes suck. What can I tell you? Hey, shit's free, okay? So just deal with it. But seriously, get some support. If you're a religious or spiritual or existential person, go get some spiritual guidance. Go get some existential support. Pray, meditate, do out-of-body experiences, whatever worked for you. But get some spiritual guidance, get some spiritual existential help, talk to people, get your stuff out, get your feelings out. Don't try to keep this crap in. Bad, 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 bad idea. Really, really bad idea. Don't try to do this on your own. Most people can't, and those who do, it takes them usually a lot longer than if they were just to belly up to the counseling bar, so to speak, or belly up to the existential person's bar, or their parents or whatever, or their best friends or teachers they trust or coaches or whatever. But get some help. Get some support. Attend a suicide survivor support group. Do whatever works for you, right? If you are a person who's contemplating suicide, get help. I mean, please. Suicide is almost never, and I won't say never because, we all know that absolutes are almost never right, right? But suicide is almost never, 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 almost never, never, ever, ever, never, ever. Did I mention almost never? Ever the right answer. It's just, I'm sorry. My personal belief system is it isn't. And again, this is not from, I'm not going to be preaching at you. This is not some, oh my God, you're going to hell. This is really about, and I don't know how else to say this without sounding corny, so I'm just going to sound corny, okay? It's really about being better than whatever it is that's confronting you, because all of us can do that. All of us, and you guys have heard me say this before too, you're probably ready to barf, right? Find the power inside of you. There is great power inside of each and every one of you, but you've got to take it, you've got to own it, you've got to claim it, and then you've got to work. Oh my God, he said that frickin' obnoxious, hugely offensive four-letter word once again. Yep, I sure did. I'll tell you, living well is hard, and it requires hard work all the time. Right? There is no easy answer to life, to living fully. Existing, any frickin' body on the planet can do that shit. But to really live a meaningful life according to your religious, spiritual, ethnic, racial, ethical, moral, whatever. Living the good life, however you define that, in a healthy sort of way, is a lot of work. I mean, it gets some easier as an adult, but not really. It gets easier because you practice it. And I will say, the more you practice healthy stuff, the easier the healthy stuff becomes. But likewise, the more you practice stupid stuff and depressing stuff and, you know, crazy dysfunctional behavior stuff, the easier that gets too. So it works both ways. But if you are one of these folks who is contemplating it or whatever, please, 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 please get help. Please, please, please don't do something stupid that you might not live to regret. I can honestly say I don't know of anybody in my immediate world, so to speak, who's done that. But I certainly have had people in my not-so-immediate world who've done that. And I've certainly worked with a lot of folks who've been that. And I can tell you that it really, really sucks. The survivors pay a very, very high price for being survivors, particularly if it's a family member. It's really, really hard. It's just really, really hard. And I always feel really, really sad and really, really bad for folks when they come in with this. I can honestly say that I've never had a patient suicide, and I'm really, I am so thankful for that, because given the kind of folks that I see, my population is pretty prone to that kind of thing, and I'm really lucky. And it's not because I'm a great, you know, therapy person or whatever. It's because I'm just been really damn lucky. My compulsivity hasn't hurt me any, because if I suspect somebody's doing that, I'm calling them like every day at the house. How you doing? How's it going? You need to see me? Yada yada. I do very aggressive work with these folks in terms of frequency and support and giving them very active stuff. I get, you know, if I'm working with a teen, I get his or her parent involved if they have a decent parent or friends or coaches or what. I mean, I do whatever the heck I can do to keep that person functional and alive until that person's in a better place. And if I can use religious guilt and the person sees it as a sin, they're uber religious, boy, let me tell you what. I actually have. I know you guys are going to go, oh my God, he has not done that. Well, I have to tell you, I have. I have to fess up. I have, absolutely. I had a person come in one time, a teenager, said, you know, if I didn't think it was the ultimate sin, and I'm not talking about him listening to Ozzy, and, you know, he wanted to get me started me about that, because any of you parents out there, whatever, heard Suicide Solution, it's not about killing yourself, okay? It's an anti-suicide song. It's really him talking about how dumb he was being an alcoholic, that, you know, that it's a good way to kill himself. So, you know, get over it. But I had somebody come in, a teenager come in and said, you know, if I didn't think it was, you know, the ultimate sin and I wouldn't go to heaven, you know, I would probably do it tomorrow. And you can bet your bippy I did nothing to disabuse that teenager of that teenager's belief system until that teenager was well on the other side of going, yeah, you know, I'm glad I didn't do that shit. And I'm like, mm-hmm, me too. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I'll cheat and take whatever the heck I can get if I can keep somebody alive. Because I do believe that life is valuable in this regard. And I do believe that life is worth living and that everybody has the power to do it well, but they have to work at it. And my job is to teach them how to do it and support it and sometimes kick them in the butt. But I'm a big believer in life and if the quality of life in particular. So thanks for everybody's listening to my raving and ranting, and particularly my bad jokes, which, as you've noticed, have not gotten better over the time, and they probably won't. So I'm going to leave everybody with that, and I hope this hasn't been too depressing for folks, but, you know, having seen the recent plethora of things on the news, I just felt compelled to talk about this. Since a lot of the most recent suicides seem to involve some sort of video slash internet slash whatever component, my next podcast is going to be on, for lack of a better term, and I mean no disrespect to anybody when I say this, people doing stupid shit with the internet and not being smart and not being careful. And there's a lot of people out there doing that, kid and adult. So I want to talk about some of the real dangers, and I'm not trying to scare anybody. I'm just telling them like it is. And I think some of you have, with the recent events that have been on the news media in the last couple of weeks, and those a while back of the student that killed himself after he was inappropriately outed as gay by the hidden camera dilly, I really want to talk about this because this is serious stuff, and this is not just, oh, we were playing a prank, oh, we thought it was a good joke, or, oh, I want to get some support, so I'm going to, you know, show my tattoo on the internet and have everybody tell me how great it is, and then everybody tells you it looks like ass, and then you feel like shit, and then you want to go do something bad. So, I mean, you know, people do stupid stuff. You know, they videotape themselves, you know, smoking marijuana and think their parents aren't going to see that shit. Oh, please, come on, you know. So I really want to talk about the dangers of the internet, and obviously I love the internet. It's a great tool, but it's like a gun. You know, guns are great if somebody's trying to break into your house and rob you and you shoot them, or, you know, if you're hunting in the woods trying to feed your family and you shoot a deer to survive, that's a great thing. If you use a gun to kill somebody, force them to do crazy sexual acts, rob them, whatever, that's bad. Okay, so the internet's a great tool if you use it correctly. It's a really crappy tool if you don't, kind of like a gun. So we want to talk about using the tool more effectively next time and more responsibly. Thanks again for listening. I hope everybody has an uber awesome existence until we meet again. Always remember, you're worth it, but it does take work, and you can do it, because anybody who puts forth the work and does the work in the right way is going to see positive results. Live long, prosperous, and awesomely self-fulfilling lives. Thanks for listening.